Well, we're going to begin tonight the book of Esther, finally. And this is an interesting story. To give us a little bit of background as to the purpose and the reality of why the book of Esther was perhaps entered into the scriptures for us, because it's been questioned by many, many scholars, by Bible students over the ages, as to whether or not the book of Esther should have been entered into the scriptures. The reason for that has been primarily because the name of God is not once mentioned in this book. You will not see prayer taking place in this book. You will not see the worship or sacrifices or offerings done in this particular book. And so people have thought, hey, this is just some writing that God entered in to the Holy Scriptures. But what the book of Esther really involves, it makes sense that those elements that we normally find in the scriptures are missing. Because what the book of Esther really tells us and informs us about and educates us on is God's provision for his people, even when they are not in his will and where they're supposed to be. And I personally am grateful and thankful for the book of Esther, because I have been in that posture myself. And to see what God does in providing for his people, even when they are faithless, realizing that he is faithful still, even when we're not. You see, the story takes place, this book of Esther, in the times of the captivity of the children of Israel. If you recall, Zerubbabel was raised up in the days of the Babylonian captivity to go back after 70 years of captivity, go back to Jerusalem and begin to rebuild the temple. And then later on, Ezra was raised up to go continue the work. And then finally, Nehemiah. We've just finished those books, that study. Now, this book, Esther, takes place while those things are taking place. Somewhere in the neighborhood of Ezra 7 and 8 is where you will find this particular story taking place, but not in Jerusalem, not in the place where God was to be worshipped and offerings were to be made, but in Persia, in a city called Shushan or Susa. It was the place that the kings of Persia used to retreat to in the winter. It was a winter retreat for many years, finally became the capital, really, of Persia. So this is where the story takes place. In that time, while Ezra is in Jerusalem doing the work of God, and remember, we talked about the fact that when the freedom was given to the children of Israel to go home after their captivity, God promised they could go back. Remember now, only some 50-odd thousand people went back initially. Everybody else stayed in Babylon, which was then, of course, taken over by the Persians. They stayed there. Why? Well, because they became comfortable there. It was a ruin they looked at Jerusalem as. It was a wreck. The place had been destroyed. Why go back there? You see. So they stayed in the place of comfort, sacrificing the worship, sacrificing all the things that God would want them to come back to. The book of Isaiah, as you know, is a book of calling the people back to God. And over the years, the prophets would just desire Jeremiah later on, come back. What are you doing staying there in Persia, in that Babylonian kind of environment? Why don't you come home? And the people didn't. They stayed there. So here's the story of Esther. And the reason you won't see God's name mentioned, prayer mentioned, or any of the offerings and sacrifices taking place is because they weren't going on. The people were not practicing, if you would, their faith. They weren't going through all those things that they were going through in Judah, back there in Jerusalem. They weren't practicing that, offerings and sacrifices and prayers and all the rest. God's name isn't mentioned. But here's the beauty of this book. You will see God all over it, even though his name isn't mentioned. It's one of the most profound books and profound stories, and you'll see the Lord throughout it, even though his name isn't mentioned. And I need to say this many times. That is the true reality. In this world we live in, God's name isn't mentioned much. If it is, it's usually used in a vain way or in a cursing way. But let me tell you, God is in control of this earth and of this place, and his will be done. This is kind of that kind of story where we see that God is in control, even though we would say, man, this looks like they're in Persia and things are going awry and God's people aren't where they belong. Well, I need to say this. Many of God's people aren't where they belong. And you can be thankful that God just doesn't forsake you and leave you when that's so. Now, these people certainly had an opportunity to go home. They didn't take it. But I need to ask you that same question. How many times has God called you to come home and you didn't come? Come home. Come out of that. Come away from that, you see. Take this personal, folks, because it's a personal book. How many times has that taken place? Come home. Come out of that. Come away from that, God says, and we refuse. We stay there in Babylon, which is, of course, rebelliousness. Now, who wrote this book is the next question, and I'm going to take a little time to cover. We're only going to probably get through the first chapter tonight, maybe. Who wrote this book? Well, that's a good question, and again, the scholars argue about it. I personally believe the answer is found in chapter 9, verse 29, and I'll tell you why I believe that the whole book was written by this man in a minute. In verse 29 of the ninth chapter, towards the end, it says, "Then Esther, the queen, the daughter of Abihail, and Mordecai, the Jew, wrote with all authority to confirm this second letter of Purim." We know that Mordecai, who we'll pick up in this story, was a Jew living there. He was a uncle, if you would, of Esther, one that took her in when her parents were killed. Mordecai was probably the author of this writing. It mentions that in that verse there that we just read, that he wrote at least the addendum or the letter of Purim. The Feast of Purim began there with what took place in this particular story. The Feast of Purim is still celebrated by the Jews, which kind of, again, verifies the authenticity of this book, because without this book, you would have no Feast of Purim. The Feast of Purim is that celebration that Jews continue to this day in the deliverance that they received from Haman, who was a man in this story who will try and kill the Jews. And yet he's not allowed to do that by God's providence, again, and God's provision. He's not allowed to do it. The Jews celebrate Purim as a result of that deliverance from Haman there in Persia in this story. So just to kind of give you an idea of what that really is all about and who wrote this, I believe Mordecai was the one that wrote it. Again, not being dogmatic about this, we don't know for sure, but it seems like that's where the evidence points. Now, this book, above all books in the Bible, is held with high esteem by the Jews, interestingly enough. It is declared by the Jews that this book stands next to in priority to the Torah, the law. And the Jews have declared, even in many of the rabbinical writings, that all the other scriptures may pass away, but the law, the Torah, and the book of Esther will not. So they value this story exceedingly because of what it means in the context, again, of this thing called providence. Now, what is providence? Well, the word providence simply means to provide. It means God provides for you. When does he provide for you? He always provides for you. You know, you're breathing, right? I don't know about you, but I eat dinner tonight, you know. all these things that I enjoy, we enjoy, God's provided them all. James says every good and perfect gift comes down from the Father of light. He provides. He's a provider. And God's provision for these people is an interesting picture also of how God will not allow the Jews to ever be exterminated, like Haman in our story, as we'll see later on, wanted to do, as people from the very beginning of the Jewish nation wanted to do to the Jews. Isn't it interesting? How many times have people and nations and leaders and rulers wanted to wipe out the Jews? To this day, we have the Arabs wanting to destroy the Jews, completely annihilate them off the face of the map, right? Hitler gave it a try, didn't he? But God won't allow it. God's provision, his providence for his people, he provides for them. After 2,000 years of being scattered from their homeland, they still exist. Why? Because God is preserving them. And he will not allow them to be exterminated. See, not going to happen. And boy, I'll tell you what, the Jews are protected in this, as they are here and as today. You see, he's still preserving them. They're still around, and they will continue to be until the very, very end. Now, this time, again, takes place kind of between maybe 465 B.C., varying in dates to maybe 510, 520 B.C. So you get the idea of when this took place. Again, this is a story that has some provision in it as a primary note, but what I need you to kind of pay attention to throughout the story. It's a great story. You can read it from cover to cover, so to speak. It doesn't take long. And maybe you've seen that movie, One Night with the King. It's about Esther. You can get it at, you know, the video store. And it's, you know, it's a Hollywood deal, but it stays along the story pretty well, except for some things, you know, they had to throw in there just to, you know, whatever. But it does follow the storyline pretty well. But here's the thing. This is it's an interesting story in the terms that it's given. I mean, it's just an entertaining story for one thing. But here's the thing. There is typical, or what we would call the types and pictures of Christ and plans of redemption, all that within this story. Remember now, Jesus is on every page of the scriptures. He is the Word of God, isn't he? And throughout this story, we will see that again. We will see all kinds of wonderful things that are mentioned here. Now, let's kind of get started before I go too long in the introduction here. This is a great story. Verse 1. Now, it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This is the Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even into Ethiopia over 127 provinces. Now, this guy, this king of Persia, his name doesn't really mean that's his name. And it's kind of a good thing, because who wants to be called that? Who can pronounce it? You know, that's the deal, you know. But here's the thing. It's a title. This is like Caesar in the Roman Empire. It's a title. His name really was Xerxes. Now, that's a better name, but not by much. Remember now, there was another king that had a similar name, Artaxerxes. Remember him in our story through Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, this Xerxes, this is a man who is the grandson of Cyrus. Remember Cyrus? He was the one who got the vision, so to speak, remember, to let the people go. More than likely, Daniel had told Cyrus about the fact that Isaiah had prophesied about him 200 years before he was ever born. Remember that whole endeavor. So Cyrus was born and ruled, and then he was the one that let Zerubbabel go back. And then later on, Darius, his son Darius, remember him, ruled. And now the son of Darius is this man, Xerxes. So you got to get an idea of where he fits in. But his name is Xerxes with an X, not Ahasuerus. So, you know, that's his title. Now, the interesting thing about his title, though, is it means, now listen to this, his name means King of Kings, the title. Now, I want you to understand something. In the pictures and types throughout the scriptures, oftentimes the Lord pulls out of these types of stories, and we've seen it over and over again, haven't we? He pulls out a type, even though the person in reality is not anything necessarily like Jesus. But here's a picture, here's a type. This guy's name means King of Kings. Now, he's going to have to answer for that because he's not the King of Kings. But I believe God will use it in the scriptures to paint a picture for us. Now watch. So his name means that. His title means the King of Kings. And he's over this huge 127 provinces. Tremendous empire, the Persian Empire was. Gigantic, you know, world power. That in those days, verse 2, when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the palace. Palace here, perhaps more accurately, would be fortress or castle. It was a fortress built around it. The palace was within that, but there was this tremendous stronghold there. And watch this now. In the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants. In the third year of his reign, he began to invite people to come to a feast. Now, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles, princes, and the provinces being before him, he invites all these rulers around him to come to this feast, you see. And here's the interesting thing. Again, keep in mind, this is a true story. This is an accurate story of what took place here. But I want you to see, because, again, God's name isn't mentioned in this story at all, but I want you to see the layout that God does in the midst. And this is the thing you're going to have to understand. Throughout everything that's going on in this world, God's hand is woven through it, and he has a part in it, and will do things that are amazing to extract and pull out his will, even though people's lives are far from it. Even though the world is a wreck, God's will is going to be done here. You understand that? Even though people are resisting him, he is going to have his way. Now watch what this means. It's just interesting to me. So here's the picture. This man, whose name means King of Kings, in the third year of his reign, has a feast and invites the princes and the nobles. Now, here's the thing, folks. The gospel feast that we are a part of presently, we are able at this particular point to eat, taste and see that the Lord is good. All the invitations. When did that invitation feast begin? When did this gospel feast begin? Well, when Jesus rose on the what? Third day. Correct? And who are we now in the kind of the midst of that feast that's taking place? Jesus said, you are now what? Priests. You see, you are the ones. You're the nobles. Now, it's just an interesting picture. So in the third year of his reign, he has his feast. The nobles are there as we represent, in a sense. And watch this now. He showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even 104 days, 181 days, 6 months. He has this feast. This is going on and on and on. This was an expensive ordeal, don't you think? I mean, these are, it doesn't tell us how many nobles, but these are from all the provinces, all the heads of 127 different provinces, and how many in their entourage, each one of them, we don't know. But this is a lot of people, and this is going on for 181 days. And when these days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people. Now, this is great. First of all, the nobles are there. Those that have received Christ first, right? We would say, in this picture that we're painting. And then what? Well, then it's opened up for everybody to come. It's an invitation for all, right? When the church was birthed, there was this handful of Jews. Listen, there's a handful of Jews. The apostles were the first, you know, in that group. And then there's others. But who were being saved initially? Jews, right? And for 10 years, really, it was really nothing more than Jews being saved and made Christians. For the first 10 years, Jesus told the disciples, if you recall, now, he said, I want you to start in Jerusalem, and then to Judea go out, and then Samaria, and then the uttermost parts of the earth, right? Well, you understand that for 10 years, they stayed in Jerusalem. They didn't go out. They just kind of hung around. So the Lord allowed there to be some persecution in the church, which scattered the people, and guess what? They went to Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the earth because God wanted the word to get out, right? So here, it starts like this with the so-called nobles or those that were first to get the picture. And then what? Then it's opened up to everybody. What did Peter see when the sheet was let down? And the Lord said, Peter, get up, kill and eat. Include the Gentiles in this is what was being said. Get everybody involved in this. Go ahead and invite them all in. So here we see all the people that were present in Shushan, the palace, both great and small, you see, were invited. And 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. Now this is interesting. 7 days they were there. Seven, of course, the number of completion. This is talking about the complete providence of God for the church. It's just this inclusive thing. It's just an amazing thing to me. Now watch this. Where were white, green, and blue hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rings and pillars of marble. The beds were of gold and silver. Now, this word bed is more accurately couches. They had couches to recline on. You know, the people in those days, in ancient times, they kind of had a good thing going on there because they would sit there on these couches. They would recline on these couches while they ate. You know, it's kind of like what we adopted as a TV dinner kind of mentality, you know. You know, sometimes you just grab your chow and go sit on the couch and whatever. But these guys would recline on couches and then kind of just eat. And then you're already postured to kind of take a nap. You know, you load up on carbs and then you just take a carbo nap right there on the couch. And then you wake up and, hey, there's food right there, you know. So that's kind of the way they did it back then. So this term bed really means couches, and the couches were of gold and silver. Now, this is important. This is interesting. Couches are what you rest on, correct? Gold is the metal of righteousness. That's why Jesus is always pictured in that light. The inside of the temple was solid gold when Solomon built it. It's the righteousness of God. So gold and silver is the metal of redemption. So here's the picture. It's interesting. These couches were of gold and silver. The couches are what the saints, you see, would rest on. Gold and silver, righteousness and redemption. This is what we rest in, isn't it? His righteousness, his redemption. The book of Hebrews says you need to enter into that rest. Not because of yourself, not because of what you do, but because of his righteousness. He redeemed you. Therefore, the couch you lay on, so to speak, that you rest in, is his righteousness and redemption. Interesting. Now, this is all going on, and I need to point out that this is actually happening. This is an extravagant affair that this king is putting on. We know historically from other extra-biblical documents that this man, this king, was actually like this. He liked to throw these big bashes. We also know some other things about him, which I'll tell you about as we go along. But he was a different kind of guy, this king, this man. Now, they were given them in drink vessels of gold. The goblets, so to speak, were gold, being diverse one from another. Every goblet was made of gold, and not one looked like another. They were all unique. They're all different. Kind of like Paul would say, the body is diverse. It's different. We're all different. We all have different gifts. We're all kind of one. We're all covered by the gold, if you would, but we're all kind of different, you know. Some are more different than others. But we're all different in our own way, yet we're all part of the gold, if you would, which is important for us to note. Being diverse one from another, and royal wine was given in abundance. Now, wine is always this picture of joy. The picture here for me is really something. And again, The Lord uses his word in this story that most people would say doesn't have anything to do with the Bible or God's plan or anything. Oh, yeah, it does. It has everything to do with it. Because here we see that this beginning of this feast that happened on the third year of his reign, for us, we would say the third day, this thing that was birthed was the church. And those that were first brought in had to share that with everybody else. Everybody eventually had to be invited to this feast. And then we see that what the guests would lean on, rest on, would be this righteousness and redemption. And then we see that, hey, there's wine in abundance, joy in abundance. Jesus said, I came to give you life, and life more abundant. And the joy of a believer's life should be evident, folks. There should just be joy for us, enjoyed by us. And this is the thing. When someone really gets a hold of the fact that they are saved, they're righteous because he said you are and made you so by his own blood, and you're redeemed by that blood, and you rest in that. You just lay down on the couch, so to speak, and you are resting in him and his righteousness. You should just have joy. There should be a lot of things can get you down, but you should never, never be able to get to a point where you still don't have joy over your redemption and the righteous standing you have in Christ. You're saved. You're going to heaven, you see. So the joy was given in abundance. Now, this is a true story again. So we have the human side of this story, and we have the picturesque wonder part. Now, that's all wonderful, but the drinking, verse 8, was according to the law. None did compel, for so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house that they should do according every man his pleasure. The problem was with this event was in the reality of it there in Persia, it was becoming a drunk fest. People were doing as much of the drinking as they want. You could do whatever you want, whatever your pleasure was. Nobody made you drink, but you could have as much of it as you wanted in this particular context. Now, again, picturesquely, it's true. With the wine, I can have as much as I want. Nobody will make you have it, as far as the joy goes, right? Nobody has to make you a joyful Christian, and some people are determined not to be joyful. You can't make me joyful. You know, nobody is going to compel them. Nobody made them drink, but you could drink as much as you want. In that sense, it wasn't good. In the, again, the realistic term of what was going on here, but in the picture form, it is an awesome picture, because I've mentioned this more than once. You can have as much of God as you want. You can have as much joy as you want. And the reality of it is you probably have as much as you want. See, because God says, here, have all you want. Take all you want. And if you don't want more, then you won't take more. And nobody can make you take more. But here's the thing. Every man in this particular context was doing what they felt like. So some were just getting sloshed, you know. And this was going on for a long time. And now there's a topper, a seven-day party where everybody's involved. Everybody's around. Now, this is interesting. So here's the thing. Vashti, the king's wife, says verse 9. Vashti, the queen, made a feast for the women in the royal house, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. And on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, in other words, he was drunk. When he was there, after he had drank a bunch of wine, he commanded Mahuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagatha, Zethar, and Carcass. These are great names. Anybody's just looking for a name for their child. I mean, wow. Now, these guys were the seven chamberlains, which is a nice way of saying they were the eunuchs. They were in charge of the women. And Vashti was the king's wife, but there was also a number of women in his harem, as was the custom in those days for many kings to have many wives or many women, concubines they'd be called. But he had one wife. Her name was Vashti. And all these chamberlains or eunuchs that served in the presence of Ahasuerus, the king, they were asked to bring Vashti, the queen, before the king with the crown royal to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to look on. Now, Vashti is interesting. Her name simply means beautiful woman. She was just a beauty. And her own feast was going on. Now, this is, again, this is an interesting thing. She was having her own feast with the women. The women weren't allowed to be in there with the men. They separated. They had their own thing. The men were there with the king, and they were having their own gathering. Now, when the king asked for her to come, she refuses. She says no, verse 12. She said, I'm not going to that party. Now, the big question is, why? Why did Vashti not go when the king commanded? Well, who knows? Perhaps she thought, as was the case, he was drunk. She may have assumed that because she would never have been asked to come had he not been drunk. It was an insult, and it was against their own cultural policy, so to speak, to have her come in there, especially in this kind of context. Now, picture this now. The king is there. He's drunk as a skunk, and probably all the other people around him are drunk. And in the drunken stupor, he says, go get my wife. Bring her in here. And he wants to parade her in front of all these other drunks. So she probably understood that. And she said, I got my own party, and I'm not going. I'm not going to do it. She refuses to come to the king's party on his commandment by his chamberlains. Therefore was the king very wroth, and his anger burned in him. Now, we're not going to get into the details of whether Vashti was right or wrong in not coming to the, you know, king's party when he was drunk and she refused to come. The fact is that probably, if you want to break this down into the narrow nitty-gritty of things, she was right, he was wrong, right? I mean, she probably had a good point. You know, I'm not going to parade myself. You know, it's just an insult, and it's not appropriate. And you're drunk, you should probably sober up and think about it later, you know, which is probably what she was assuming would happen. Maybe he'll just straighten up when he comes to his senses, you know. But here's the picture for him, for me. When we keep the pattern of this feast and the invitation for all to come, we're reminded, at least I am, of a great feast, a supper that Jesus talked about, where he informs the disciples and those that were listening that there is a supper going on. There is a great supper and an invitation for those that are all around to come and come to this great supper. The invites are out, and yet many of those said what? Oh, we've got a piece of property we need to go look at. Or we've got a deal over here we've really got to take care of. You know, thanks anyway. Right? And Jesus said many would refuse to come to the feast. Vashti has this opportunity to be, in this sense, the bride, so to speak. But she refuses. She says, no, I'm not going to. Now, again, in the reality of the story, yes, she's got a right to say no. But here's what's interesting as we get through this now. Watch this. The king said to the wise men, which knew the times, for so was the king's manner toward all that knew the law and judgment. And the next unto him was Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marcena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, which saw the king's face and which sat the first in the kingdom. So these were the closest counselors to the king. These were the guys that would give him counsel, and they'd all discuss things that should be policy and all that. They were his cabinet, if you would, you know, the administration for his kingdom. So what shall we do unto the queen Vashti according to law, because she hath not performed the commandment of the king Ahasuerus by the chamberlains? Now here's the problem. There was no law. See, in that culture, the king was the king, and everybody in the kingdom was slaves under him except for his wife. And there was no law about her not coming to a banquet. So they asked the question, you know, what are we going to do according to the law? Well, there isn't any law about this, is what they have to discuss among themselves. So what are we going to do about that? Because there isn't a law. Well, when there isn't a law and you need one, what do? Make one up. We need a law that'll cover this, you see. So this man, Memucan, now this guy has been, by many, many Bible scholars, thought to be one of these guys that is totally henpecked by his wife. And the reason is, watch this now, he answers before the king. He's the first to pipe up. And he says to this king that's having this problem and the princes, Vashti the queen hath not done wrong to the king only, but also to all princes. Now, what is he? He's a prince. And to all people that are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. Hey, you weren't the only one that's been duped here and has a problem now. We all have a problem. Now, I've got to go home, is what he's saying. Now, I've got to go home, and my wife's not going to listen to me. Well, chances are, Memucan, your wife wasn't listening to you in the first place. And that's why he knows this is so. It's going to be worse for him. So he's like, whoa, hey, we've got a problem here. Because your wife, the queen, has just set the tone now for the whole place. And we're all going to suffer for it. That's funny. Now, he goes on, for this deed of the queen, verse 17, shall come abroad unto all women. Every woman in the whole region's going to hear about this. In all of your provinces, all 127 of them. Now, he's stretching things a bit, don't you think? He's so concerned about his own situation that he's boasting that everybody, every woman, every household is going to be affected by this particular deal. And all the women will have this same issue, so that they shall despise their husbands in their eyes when it shall be reported. When everybody hears about this, when the headlines come out tomorrow morning, we are in trouble. When CNN gets a hold of this, the whole place is going to be up for grabs because of this particular event. The king Ahasuerus commanded Vashti, the queen, to be brought in before him, but she came not. Ooh, man, this is the report that everybody's going to be hearing. Everybody's going to hear this, you see. Now, we know from history that this king was a man of vengeance. We know he was a man that sought revenge when something happened. We understand this is the same Xerxes that tried to take over the whole world. He wanted, in fact, this particular gathering to be the precursor, the support for his plan to take over the whole world. He was buttering up all the leaders of the provinces, showing the wealth and getting them to drink with them and party with him for 6 months, because he was going to outline his plan to attack the provinces that were outside of his realm. We know that that took place in actuality around 480 BC. He did that, and he got whipped soundly. He got taken down. And we know that when he got taken down, he went out because some of his ships were destroyed by the enemy. That he went out and he took a stick, a rod, and started beating the waves in the sea, in the ocean, at the beach. He was a little disturbed, this guy. He went down there and just started whacking on the waves, you know, like it was their fault, you know. And he was, of course, a man who had some issues with authority, as we can see. You know, it's been well noted that if a man has to prove he's in authority, he's not. If you've got to figure out whether somebody's in authority, then they're probably not in authority, you know. I always love when Jesus ministered, because he would go about doing the things he was doing with authority, right? And nobody questioned whether he had authority. They always wondered where he got it, but they never questioned that he had it. You know, when he purged the temple, they'd run out. Nobody stopped him, and they'd get outside and go, how'd you do that? I mean, we know you did it. And we know you have authority, but where did you get that authority? They never questioned his authority. He had it. And this is this king's problem in his personal life. But here's the thing. In this story, I think what we draw from it picturesquely is the fact that the queen refuses to come. She is a picture, if you would, of one who refuses to come to the feast, you see. And all these men now are saying, well, what's my wife going to do now when I get home? You know, likewise, verse 18, shall the ladies of Persia and Media say this day unto all the king's princes, which have heard of the deed of the queen, thus shall there arise too much contempt and wrath. We are going to face wrath when we go home, is what these guys are saying. Well, my guess is it's already there. If it's caused by some incident that a queen kind of performs one act and the whole place falls apart and every woman is going to take that out on her husband, well, then there's something already wrong there. Now, if it please the king, verse 19, let there go a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes that it not be altered, that Vashti come no more before the king Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal state unto another that is better than she. Now, this correlates in some regards to what Jesus said would happen when those that are invited to come refuse. He said that there's an opportunity for those to come and enjoy the feast. He uses several illustrations to make that clear and tells it in parable form oftentimes. But the indication that he always gives is that you're invited to this thing, but if you don't come, then you're left out. You have to come to the Lord. The idea here is that she needed to come to the king, correct? But she had her own thing going. She had her own feast. She had her own banquet, so to speak. So she wasn't interested in his. This is kind of, again, this idea that is painted in the Gospels so often, that there is an opportunity to be with the king and his feast and his supper, and yet people are not interested because they have their own thing. They have their own supper. They have their own interest, and they're not interested in him. See? And what happens is, of course, they're left out. And the picture here, what's being said about this wife, this Vashti, is that there's going to be another to take her place. Someone else is going to take her place. In the parable of the talents, which is not, by the way, a picture of personal salvation there in Matthew chapter 25, it speaks of the nations that will be either the sheep nations or the goat nations, you know. But there is, in that particular context, Jesus says, remember the one servant who was given the one talent and he never used it? He buried it. And when his master came back, he said, here, this is yours. Take it back. The nations of this world that are offered that, the people in this world that are offered that and don't receive it, don't take it, then that is taken in what? Jesus said, take that in what? Give it to another. And he'll have an abundance. And this one will have nothing. There's the kind of the indication that's going on here. She's going to be removed, and someone else will take her place. You see, there's going to be something else here moving into her spot, so to speak. And this is an interesting thing, because it says, verse 20, when the king's decree which he shall make shall be published throughout all his empire, for it is great, all the wives shall give to their husbands honor, both great and small. Now, is that true? No. Making a decree, a commandment that wives should honor their husbands, is not going to make it so, is it? You cannot put into law that reality. You know, as much as some men might want that to be a law, it's not going to happen. You can't just say, okay, honey, here's the law. You're supposed to do this and do that and honor me in every way. Okay, so there's the law, so that's why you should do it. Is that the motivation to cause a wife to honor her husband? No. The law doesn't cause people to do things like that, does it? If it did, we wouldn't need grace. We wouldn't need Jesus on the cross, because the law would have just said it and we would have done it. But nobody got saved by the law. No one is justified by the works of the law. So here, the law being laid down, so to speak, for this group of wives that these men want to have honor from, the law doesn't do it. It never makes it happen. And it says, though, in verse 21, the saying pleased the king and the princes. Oh, it pleased them. We made up a law that says this is so. Now, why would they make up that law so that they could implement this? Did they really believe that their wives would truly honor them? That they would love them more because they made a law for their wives to have to do that? Of course not. But they needed a means by which to exercise the authority. They had no law in place before, so they made one so that they could do what they needed to do when their wives wouldn't honor them. Now, this is a pagan culture, so don't try and read into this idea that these people were all together in righteous and all the rest. These were pagan Persians, you see. They didn't have any godly attributes whatsoever. So these are all just made up things that the world will do similar things. The world tries to make laws up that don't have any righteous bearing whatsoever, doesn't it? So here, that pleased them to make a law that would enforce what they wanted to see happen. And the problem with that is, of course, is it wasn't going to make it happen. It would just give them a means to enforce discipline when it didn't happen, which is what they were looking for. They were looking for a way to get Vashti out of the picture. Now, see, that's the reality of what's going on here. What a stark contrast to what the Lord is doing, isn't it? Because his word is to invite, come. You know, come, come on in. Everybody, come, you see. But for this particular reality, when someone says, no, I'm not coming, then the reality is that they are left out. And then verse 22 says, for he sent letters into all the king's provinces, into every province according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, that every man should bear rule in his own house, and that it should be published according to the language of every people. They wanted to make sure everybody had this written in their law, in their language. Why? So that the men... Now, this is interesting, because you see this happening to this day. It's always been this way. Oftentimes, laws or rules, so to speak, like this, are made up. Now, who were the ones that were really concerned about this? Was it the men in all the villages and provinces all over the empire? No. Who was concerned about it? A handful of nobles, so to speak, these leaders. And oftentimes laws are made and passed because there's a handful of people that are concerned about it. Has nothing to do with what's good for the people necessarily. Has to do with the political, you know, agenda, so to speak. So here we see that same thing. Things don't change. This is, you know, back in 500 BC, and still nothing has changed since then, has it? Still have a handful of people trying to pass laws that don't benefit anybody but them. And this still goes on. And here we see the epitome of that. They made this happen so that they could go home and say, okay, now, see this, honey? It's the law. Law. See? Now, the question is, how far did that go? You know, how long did it take for the rolling pin to come out when the thing got posted on the refrigerator? Look, it's the law. You need to do what I say, you know. Well, it didn't make it happen, but see, again, they needed justification for what they were going to have to do if, in fact, the wife wasn't going to do it, you see. It's been well pointed out again and again, you know, that throughout the ancient cultures of the world, in all of history, women have been in a state of oppression, if you would. Although I have a feeling they had their day when the time came. Even in these times, we see it happening. These guys are kind of running scared, aren't they? Did you hear what Vashti did? You know, you guys are real manly, you know. You're scared of what Vashti did, you know. You're just wimps, really. They're just like, oh no, what are we going to do now? Are you going to go home and face your wife? No, I'm not going home. You going home? Not without the law. Not without some piece of paper that says this is the law. You know, as if that's going to do it, you know. But it's been well noted that Christianity really did the liberating for women. It was the Bible that first said there is no difference, male, female, you know, Jew, Greek, whatever. We're all on an equal plane with the Lord. Now, is there order in God's economy? Absolutely. Is it God's plan that a man be the spiritual leader over his wife and family? Absolutely. Does it work when that order is kept? Sure does. But it's not a matter of who's superior, is it? And this is important for us, getting away from the Persian culture here for a minute and into our reality. The order God gives for his church, if you would, is that men lead. And why is that? Well, Paul explains to Timothy the reason that it's important for men to lead. And by the way, in the church, it is the men that are to lead. It is the men who are to have the teaching authority in the church. And people say, well, why is that? I think some women could be good teachers. They could be great teachers. And here's the reality. Men aren't necessarily the most spiritual, are they? In fact, I think if you just go take a scan of all the believers in the world, the women are the ones that show up to Bible study and prayer nights much more than men do. So what's the deal? Well, in God's wisdom, and again, Paul points this out to Timothy, that men need to be the ones leading. Why? Well, it started back in the garden, if you recall. There they were, Adam and Eve, right? First people. And there they were having a great time, you know. But the serpent, Satan, came to Eve, didn't he? And why didn't he go to Adam? Now, women, don't get offended here. Why didn't he go to Adam? Well, here's the deal. Paul mentions to Timothy that Eve was deceived. Not that she wasn't spiritual, not that she didn't have the desire to be spiritual, but she was deceived by the enemy in this one context. God made man first. Listen, he made man first and said, now this is a man, and I want a helpmeet for him. So he made what? A woman, correct? And so the man was made first, then the woman. And the order was that the man would be the protector, the covering for the wife. And the wife was to be his helpmeet. The completer is what the word really means. Man is complete with his woman, with his wife, so to speak. But in the garden, the serpent comes to Eve. And what was his temptation to Eve? What was it that he tempted her with? Was it with some sinful, scathing thing that... No. Did she, you know, have to resist the devil when he came and did all this wicked stuff before and said, aren't you interested in this? No. What did he say to Eve? You want to be more like God, don't you? Yeah, I do, she said. And you want to be more spiritual, don't you, Eve? Yeah. Now the question is, who are you going to be more spiritual than, Eve? There's only one other person on earth. That would be your husband. Right? Her temptation was to be more spiritual than Adam. And that's what she was deceived by, the enemy, over that issue. So when she caved in, now what happened then? Listen, what happened when Eve then, who was deceived, fell into that temptation of wanting to disorder what God had ordered? What happened? She led him, didn't she? Into what? Here, you should have some of this. Ah. Now, Paul says that's the issue. It's not that women are not spiritually inclined. They're more spiritually inclined than men are. Men, we're just kind of blockheads. I mean, guys are just like, yeah, you know. I mean, spirituality is kind of like, huh? But, but we're kind of solid once we get it, aren't we? I mean, guys aren't the brightest thing in the world. Like, you know, we're kind of like, you know, but Once we get it, we stay solid. Now, women, more spiritually minded, but they tend to want to go into an area, listen, where it disrupts the order. And this is the key. Not that they don't have any business being spiritual or seeking God or any of that, but when it usurps authority over the man, the order is disrupted. God's plan, God's way, is interfered with, and this is why God says, don't do that. Paul was the one who said, husbands, love your wives, lead your wives, wash them in the water of the word, right? Be the leader. Now, why is it that Paul reiterates that, what God has established as the order? Because here's the thing, guys, men, by their very nature, the innate nature of a man is not to lead spiritually. The question always pops up, where was Adam anyway when Eve was being deceived? When he was out probably building their house or something. I mean, he was doing something. You know, he's off doing whatever and not covering her. She was left unattended, so to speak, for the serpent to get in there and deceive her. The men of God's plan are to be the leaders because they naturally don't do it. It is their act of submission. Paul says that we are submitted one to another, and first we're submitted to God. How are we submitted to God as men? We are submitted to Him as we submit to our role as leaders, leading our wives. It's not the most natural thing. If you're a man in here and you think being a spiritual leader is natural, raise your hand. It's not, is it? It's like, what? Do what? How about read your Bible to your wife? Huh? What? How about pray over your wife every day? Huh? You know, we're just kind of not into that. The wives, you know, I'll pray. You know, I know you don't sound like that, but you know, I'll do it. I'll pray. And it happens. It happens in churches. It happens here. If I'm not careful, the women will do it. You know. And I have to say, no, the men need to lead, you know, and come on, guys, you know, and let's, right? Because the women want to do that. So for them, listen, the order given by God is their act of submission is to let the men lead, not take the spiritual authority role. And again, that doesn't come natural to a woman. Isn't it interesting? The roles that are given to the men and the women in our lives in this thing called the plan of God is that we take the roles we're not naturally inclined to take, which requires submission to God. Okay, Lord, I'll do it. I'm not good at this, though. I hear more men say that than I can just recount. I'm not good at this. Why don't you pray with your wife? I'm just not good at that. How good do you have to be at? Just pray, you know. I'm not good at devotions. Like, what? Just read the Bible to them. I'm not good at it. Not good at the reading. You're not good at reading. Just read the Bible to your wife. You know, just let's go now. You know, and again, it's this resistance. Why? Because it's not natural and it's not the thing that we normally do. So it's our act of submission. Paul says when it happens, and this is important. I'll quit with this. I'll wrap up. Paul says it's important. Because what happens is that when a husband, as Paul puts it in Ephesians 5, when a husband loves his wife as Christ loved the church, which gave himself for her, gave up himself for his bride, Jesus died for us. When that happens and a wife experiences a husband that says, you know, I'm going to just give up myself for you. If a man loves his wife that way, I've said this before, but it's very true. I don't think there's a woman on earth that would have a problem submitting to a husband that loved her as Christ loved the church. But Paul says the first thing is to be submitted one to another. In what? In your prospective roles. Submit to your role out of respect for God and keep the order what it is. What we see here in Persia and in every other culture and every other instance, including in the church, we see the disorder. Don't we? And again, I'll probably get letters Wouldn't be the first time for me. And I hesitate to say this, but I could probably say it anyway, but I do not believe women should teach in the main teaching times of the church over the men. It is something Paul says, I do not allow them to usurp authority. And I know people have tried to twist what Paul said and say, well, he didn't mean that. He meant it. He said it, and he gave the reason for it. And so people say, well, I heard a woman on TV. She was a great preacher. I'm sure she was. Probably better than a lot of men. Not taking that away from a woman. It's just out of order. It's just out of order. And again, God's plan and the way he sets it up, it's the order. It's the way he has designed it. It doesn't have anything to do with who's better at what. In fact, I think we can probably all agree, many times the women are better at it. That's not the issue. The issue is God's order and submitting to it and then getting blessed for it because God's way works. See? So, is that a good place to end? I don't know. Maybe so. Some of you guys are going, quit while you're ahead. Pull up. You're good. You know. Man, we better pray and take communion. Lord, we thank you for your word and praise you for the things that you have given to us. The scriptures are full and rich. We thank you for the story of Esther. And in the pictures that are there, we are blessed, Lord, to come to your feast, to your supper, to take part in reclining on the righteous and redemptive work of Christ. We are so thrilled, Lord, and blessed that you have called us and have provided for us your provision, being seen even in this story, how much more for your church. You're a great God, and we bless you. We want now, Lord, to come to the table where we remember our Savior. We remember the blood and the body of our Lord who gave himself for us. And doing so, Father, we understand that there's spiritual healthiness available if we'll give value and worth to this time. If we will honor this remembrance, then you will honor it as well in our life, and there is spiritual vitality for us in doing so. So we come now to the table where we know the forgiveness has already been established, but we come in a sense, Lord, to have the cleansing of our lives, not the forgiveness of sin. We're forgiven from the time you died for our sins, but the cleansing of our lives, that part of our life that has come into contact with the world, we need it cleansed tonight. So we come and remember the work that was done and receive again the washing, the cleansing for our practical life. We commit this time to you and ask your blessing over the table. In Jesus' name, amen.